Hi, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Here in the Midwest, we really understand the idea of trying to do more with less. Divestment, crumbling infrastructures, a shrinking population, they all make life a lot harder. They make things a lot more difficult. But that doesn't mean that those of us who live in these places hate our lives or our cities. Like everyone else, we lead complicated lives here in the Rust Belt. They have many twists and turns. But mostly, we're just like everyone else, trying to find joy and levity amid sometimes really difficult situations. Author Kelsey Ronan is from one of these cities here in the Rust Belt, and it has gotten a lot of national and international attention in the past decade. She's a writer who grew up in Flint, and she's watched as her city has been captured in often oversimplistic ways that distort the very real people who live there. So she's trying to do Flint justice in some ways, and she's recently written a novel titled Chevy in the Hole, which is a reference to the old Chevy plant and soon-to-be state park in Flint. Her work leads readers through a really complicated tale of addiction, family history, and romance. And in it, she left me thinking, what do we owe these cities like Flint or Detroit that we've divested from? What do we owe the people who are trying to just live and enjoy their lives in these spaces? And what is the best way to facilitate the humanity and complexity of these places? What's the best way to recognize the fullness of life in these places? The things that other people so often dismiss. I'm really glad to have Kelsey Ronan here with us to talk about these things and more. Kelsey, welcome to Detroit Today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And I want to start with Gus, who's, of course, one of the protagonists in the book, who's recovering from an overdose and moves from Detroit to Flint to get sober and eventually falls in love with the other main character in the book, Monet. Talk about the inspiration for this story.
Sure. So Gus specifically came pretty closely from my life. I was widowed at 24. My partner died of a drug overdose. And so it wasn't something I set out to write about. I would say my attitude in my 20s was that if I got out of Flint, where he had passed and where we'd grown up together, you know, if I got out of Flint, then I just wouldn't have to think about it anymore. So, of course, by the time I hit 30 and I was living in St. Louis and the water crisis broke, that was proving to be very much not true. So these stories that I had been working on about a family that in some ways mirrored mine. My grandfather, like the family in the book, my grandfather had grown up in Detroit and moved to Flint in the 40s. That story started to become overtaken by this story of love and addiction. So it really was a way in which I processed grief, and it was grief both for, you know, my partner who had passed, but also for what, you know, in real time I was witnessing my hometown go through.
And that metaphor, I think, is really powerful, especially for those of us who live in places like Detroit or Flint, where we're not just dealing with the death or the struggle of the place that we're from, but that so many of us have had that close experience with somebody whose personal despair touches us so deeply. I wonder how comfortable you feel talking more about the death of your partner and the effect that that had, not just on your work here, but on you.
Sure, I feel absolutely comfortable talking about it. And I will say it's one of the gifts of, you know, the book's just been out a few weeks and it's been quite a whirlwind and quite a dream. This is my first book and I wasn't quite sure what I was getting into, but just in doing readings in the Detroit and Flint area the last couple of weeks, I've had so many people who've come up to me and said very quietly, like, you know, I too have someone in my family or am in love with someone or was in love with someone who suffered from these things too. And even though I feel like it's becoming more normalized, maybe through force of the opioid crisis of, as you said, like everyone has been touched by it in some way. And maybe there are also some things like the kind of Instagram normalization of talking about mental health, but there is still that little bit of, a feelings of like secrecy or shame in talking about addiction and in talking about grief and that fear of judgment of what people will assume about you if you bring yourself too closely into that. And I'm really happy to be breaking that open as wide as I can. I'm very happy to be honored, really, to be talking about it.
So let's talk a little about the story this book. Monet is a pretty cool character. She runs a farm in Flint. She's really quite powerful and has a lot going for her. And Gus is sort of the opposite, of course. He's really struggling. Talk about why she falls for Gus in the story and what he has that I guess she wants access to.
I think she's someone who is carrying so much. She's someone who's very young and has an enormous amount of pressure upon her. She's a caretaker in her family. She has a very small family. Her uncle is a politician, so she has both this pressure at home to help take care of her mother, who is disabled after the accident that killed her father, the pressure to take care of her, and also this pressure is just coming into like leaving college and coming into a professional career in Flint to do very well. And so I think in one way, when she meets Gus, he's this person who is in the very early stages of recovery and has a great deal of time that he's looking to fulfill, has this like emotional intensity where he's sort of immediately kind of obsessed with her and taken with her. And though she's leery of that, it is very flattering to have someone who isn't coming at her with a great deal of expectation, but just sort of lavishing time and attention on her in the ways that is both exciting and possibly problematic. I also, I see her as someone who is still processing grief. And it's a long grief in the way that often is. She lost her father some years ago, and there's pressure to quote unquote move on, to heal, to make this new life for herself. And it's become, I don't want to say taboo, but I feel like the family, her mother is moving on, is dating, and she is still very much holding her father's memory and her relationship with Gus. That becomes a place where to really access that grief, he becomes a safe space for her to do that.
I'm talking with author Kelsey Ronan about her new book, Chevy in the Hole, which takes a look at a number of different things: family, addiction, relationships, and really kind of asks us to stop and think for a moment about places like Detroit and Flint and these other Rust Belt cities that we kind of leave behind that are subject to such disinvestment and abandon it, and to ask what we owe those cities. What do we owe the people who are just trying to live and enjoy life in these spaces? What are the kinds of development and investment that we could collectively bring to underinvested neighborhoods or communities? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or you can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we will try to work you into the conversation that way. Kelsey, in the book, you explore environmental racism and particularly how the past bleeds into the present through multiple family histories. Did you plan to write that way? How did you manage to include, I guess, all of that in one story?
So much of that came from, and again, I'm going to go back to when the water crisis broke, when the news of that broke, I was living in St. Louis. And so I had very much grown up with, you know, I was born in the 80s. I had grown up in that kind of like post Roger and me Flint, where the changes and the inequities in Flint were very visual. There were things that, you know, before I could intellectually grapple with them, I think I very much internalized them. And I saw the way my neighborhood was changing. I saw the way my school was changing. And I became increasingly aware as I was living outside of the city. You know, I moved out when I was 25, of comments people would make to me about Flint, and Flint being a kind of punchline of one of those, you know, quote unquote, worst cities in America or whatever. And I thought I knew the city really well. I want to like very transparently like point to my positionality here. Like, I'm a working class person. I'm a white person. I'm a cis woman. And I knew the stories of the city from my grandparents. I knew my family's history, you know, as auto workers, as working class people. And it wasn't until the water crisis, when I was in St. Louis and looking at the distinction between the national narrative of Flint versus, you know, my phone calls home, my trips home, social media, what I was seeing, and then starting to really engage in the work of journalists who, like people like Anna Clark, of course, who wrote The Poison City, Andrew Highsmith, who amazing writer and the author of a book on Flint, Demolition Means Progress, who were unpacking that legacy in Flint of systemic racism, of environmental racism that, you know, GM, as Generous Motors, as it was called for so long in Flint, was GM Crow for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so when the water crisis happened, and there was immediately people pointing to like, this is not a coincidence that this happened to a city that is largely low income, a city that is largely Black and Brown people, and other people being like, no, this was, you're playing the race card, you're whatever, this absurdity of having those journalists point out like, no, this is the kind of climax of what's really a long and ugly history of the way the city and corporations have treated marginalized people.
And in telling the story through fiction, I guess, talk about maybe what license you felt you had that you might not have had as a journalist trying to tell that story, and I guess ways that you might have been able to, I guess, be more refined in the way that you did tell that story. I think one of the great things about fiction is that, of course, it allows us to imagine possibilities that that the real world doesn't offer. I guess talk about the process of putting this story together in that fictional way.
I think so many Flint millennials like me have grown up with always in that context of being told there was this other Flint that you didn't know, this other Flint that like closed out before you were born and you weren't there, but the population used to be four times as much. There used to be, you know, these places where you could go see amazing music, or these places where you could have whatever the experience was, the downtown streets. I think Detroit very much has that relationship to the kind of like ghosts of former eras or other generations. And so the book, and having the book be fiction, and I should stop and say that fiction is my background, and I am a voracious fiction reader. I think if I was a journalist and had the skills in research, I would have absolutely written that kind of book about the water crisis. So I'm working with the limitations of my skills. But I had a kind of strange longing for things as recent as like the Auto World theme park in the 80s, as much as that has been like lampooned. If I had a time machine, I would totally go back and go, you know? I'm so curious about that. Or, you know, like I'm a music nerd, and growing up, learning about like the jazz acts that used to come through Flint and like play the Golden Leaf or the IMA, or, you know, it being a stop on the Motown tour, like how amazing. So fiction just became a kind of, I guess, little time machine for me to move in my imagination back to those places, to imagine what it was like. And also I got really deeply into research with this book, but largely through oral archives. So looking at the stories that had not been immediately accessible through my understanding of Flint, to, again, like women, to people of color, and looking at their experiences through oral archives at the public library, through newspapers, through, documentaries, smaller budget things that I could find on YouTube about like the women's auxiliary of the sit-down strike, for instance. Mm-hmm. Going back and seeing how even those kind of like glory days of Flint, the things that people in like MLive comments love to point back to of like, oh, back before, you know, insert your agenda here, back before that happened, things were so beautiful. Like, well, that was never quite true. You know, it was never beautiful for everybody. It was never equal access for everybody. So having a place in fiction to access both like the novelties and the big moments and the landmarks in Flint's history, but also to look at the different facets of it, of what was true and not for people at that time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with author Kelsey Ronan. I want to get going on the phones and on social media as well. Call and tell us what you think we owe cities like Detroit and Flint that we have divested from, walked away from. Also, talk about how we take care of the people in places like Detroit and Flint, given that disinvestment, given the desperation that attends a lot of our lives, which we're just really trying to live and enjoy. Also, give us a call and let us know about your experience with people who suffer from addiction. Another one of the big themes in Chevy in the Hole, how we feel, how we react when people close to us go through that kind of crisis. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook, or Twitter, and put comments there. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm talking with author Kelsey Ronan. Her book, Chevy in the Hole, takes a look at a number of different dynamics in our lives, including romance and loss and love, but also takes a look at cities like Detroit and Flint, places that so many of us love so deeply, but that have been terribly neglected for such a long time, and where life is pretty difficult for a lot of us. What do we owe to those cities that we have disinvested in so profoundly? What do we owe the people who live in those cities? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation that way. Kelsey, Flint has this image of being deserted that we've been talking about, and I think that leads a lot of people to believe that no one wants to live there, for instance, or that no one who matters to any of us would actually live there. I want you to talk just a little about the Flint that you know, how you experience it, and how you imagine it.
Sure. I mean, I've had the honor of talking about this quite a bit recently, but when I was in St. Louis and the water crisis story was first breaking, it was confusing in part because there was this narrative that I was following through national media outlets like the New York Times, where the story was very much that this was an absolute catastrophe, which is true, but that the response was that anyone who had any means whatsoever was leaving Flint immediately, and that Flint, the only people left would be the people who were frankly too poor to leave. And I don't want to dismiss that as the reality for people. There's been a huge betrayal in Flint, and there is there are many people who are disenfranchised and feel they don't have those choices. But at the same time, it was odd to be watching these stories and to hear these projections of the population loss of people leaving in droves. But at the same time, like, it's a city where my family is, again, working class people. It's the city where I lived until I was 25. I have lots of wonderful friends there still, lots of connections to that community. I didn't know anyone that was leaving. If anything, I know so many people who have moved into Flint from the suburbs or from farther away in the last years, looking at Flint as, as an opportunity to launch small businesses, to do interesting things, people identifying these gaps in the community and these needs to fill, and people who are just ride or die for Flint and would never live anywhere else, who have tremendous pride in the city. So that was not a story that I saw told. And I think we see that in like the many, many activists that have stepped up in the water crisis and after, and frankly, who were doing that work before. So that's certainly something, in the city I would that makes me feel so much like hope and pride in Flint, but also a story that I wish was lifted up more.
What do you think it would take to repair Flint, to make it, I guess, whole again? And by that, I mean, not just the way it was before the water crisis, but the way it was a long time ago, where there was much more opportunity and much more stability. I'm always curious how people who are from Flint think of the city's future.
Sure. And I wish that I had a profound answer to that. And I think if I did have a profound answer to that, I would like move back now and run for city council or something, you know, like I don't know. I can certainly point to the many issues, you know, in Flint, things like employment, things like, you know, repairing the legacy of Flint as, you know, this one industry factory town. Looking at things like education again, and in environmental, the kind of phytoremediation efforts of the actual, you know, pulling the toxins that industry left in the soil and reusing that land and making it healthy again. But God, as far as what exactly, what would be the dream plan for Flint moving forward? I'm very sorry to say that I'm too ignorant to know, but that there are so many people that I have hope in, and I'm excited to see where they go.
Well, one thing I think that we can hope for, at least, is that that the stories that get told about Flint are maybe richer or more accurate, more reflective of the experience that people who are from there actually have. You were talking earlier about Roger and Me, the movie by filmmaker Michael Moore, and your sort of view of how that portrayed Flint. I think we've come a really long way from that kind of one-sided, maybe, view of the city, and there is a richer storytelling, I think, that's taking place.
There is. I mean, there are so many people. There's so many names that are just like I just want to shout out right now of people who are truly inspirational people, but who are doing that work as, you know, Flint folks, of telling its story and telling it with joy and telling it with nuance. I'm thinking of, you know, the folks at East Village Magazine, nonprofit community-based newspaper that has become such a hub, you know, for information and telling neighborhood-based stories and getting to the root of city politics that's hard to do in, you know, the age of MLive and the, which is not a dig at MLive at all, but in the, you know, the absence of a lot of community-based journalism. I'm like, one of my favorite people in Flint is Egypt Otis, who started a bookstore in downtown Flint, opened during the pandemic, and the work she is doing to promote literature and storytelling and culture in Flint, and the voices she is lifting up at Comma Bookstore downtown, utterly amazing. The musician Tunde Alanaran, their music, again, amazing. These high profile now, like, just to pretend that I'm like special too, I will say that I back in the day, like before Tunde became Tunde, they right. lived across the street. They lived across the street from my mom, and now they're doing these collaborations with like Yo-Yo Ma. Just absolutely extraordinary and so beautiful and feels to me so authentic to like the richness and the possibilities right now in Flint versus the tired, you know, doom and gloom Michael Moore narrative of like the 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm. What do you want people to take away from Chevy in the Hole? Not just about Flint, but about all the other themes and issues that you kind of raise with this really beautiful story. Is it an optimistic story, do you think? Is it just a real story? What would you hope people were inspired to think or feel?
I do think of it as a, it's funny, I've had some conversations lately about the ending of the book, which, you know, without giving anything away, in my mind is a very hopeful ending, a very optimistic ending. But I think depending on where you are in your relationship to where you live or in your romantic life, like, you know, I had a journalist ask me, like, is this a story about settling? I was like, no. I mean, I guess yes and no, but I want it to be a story about, I feel I've overused this word, but like reckoning, truly reckoning with your home. In my case, of course, that's Flint, of both what is toxic and what is beautiful about it. Interrogating family and intergenerational traumas, and as much as you are able, looking clear-eyed at where you come from and making a choice in how you respond. I'm very interested throughout the book I feel Monet is someone, as a character, who it's sort of this idea thrown at her all the time that things are just happening to her. Her falling in love just happens to her. But as she sees it, her decision to enter that relationship, her decision to be involved in urban agriculture, they're very much decisions. She's aware of who she is and where she's from, and that's growing clearer. And ultimately, it's a life that she wants and not a series of sad and strange things that just happened to her.
Yeah. Okay, Kelsey Ronan, it was really great to have you here with us on Detroit Today to talk about Chevy in the Hole, this wonderful story you told about many things, but especially about your hometown of Flint. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. This has been really great.
When we come back, we are going to talk about a new production that is coming to Chamber Music Detroit that is based on the life of a juvenile lifer. Really unusual expression of art, and a great conversation coming up next. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.